From Sylvain Labs, welcome to Critical Nonsense. On our show, we dig deep into cultural ephemera and pose questions to each other to inspire interesting conversations. This is Critical Nonsense. This week, Aaron asks Joey about baking, and Joey asks Aaron about legalized sports betting.
Woo! And in case you've forgotten, still what a Joey sounds like.
This is what an Aaron sounds like.
And this is what an aspiring bookie and executive producer Jess Vander sounds like.
Hi, this is Jess.
Oh, hi. I forgot how to podcast.
We missed you so much.
It's been so long.
I missed y'all too. It's nice to be back in the stewed with y'all.
Stew.
Great folks.
Can I just say one thing real quick that you just made me think of with your brief?
Please.
I was watching something the other day and they spelt cash in the subtitles C-A-J.
What?
Well, that's just completely wrong.
That's not right.
It is obviously C-A-S-Z-H.
Ooh, an S and a Z. Okay.
Interesting.
All right.
I was like, you can't come up with a good way to spell it.
Yeah.
They all leave you wanting without the phonetic alphabet, but that's a pretty good submission.
Yeah. Like, I'm on board with it. It's like, as per usual. Like,
yeah. U-S-Z.
Cadge.
Yeah.
Doesn't work.
Yeah.
That just sounds like uzz.
It makes you very uncomfortable. Like, makes me very uncomfortable. Yeah. Well, it's nice to be back with you fine people. I had a great relaxing respite away from the podcast last week. I spent a fair amount of time, as I have since the beginning of the year, watching more Great British Bake Off and Kitchen Nightmares back to back.
Preach.
Real different experiences. Like, Gordon Ramsay is a really insane human being, but he just cares so much about the restaurant industry. And then, you know, on Great British Bake Off, bring back Mel and Sue. Whole different thing. Anyway.
Yes.
Inspired me to start taking up my spatula and start baking, actually.
Wield your spatula.
With might.
I'm a hype man today, apparently.
I'm into it, and I appreciate it. And actually, when I was trying to figure out what the recipes were this weekend that I was going to work on, I was thinking of Joey, because he's allergic to nuts. So I just made a pistachio olive oil cake that he can only look at.
Now everyone knows I'm going to be murdered by nuts.
It will happen. But in doing it and getting back into the baking, it definitely has sparked for me a question, which is what makes baking so special?
So, I hate cooking, but I love baking. It's so satisfying. It's like magic.
Wait, can we start with why do you hate cooking?
Because it feels like a chore. I like eating, but it feels like you're doing more work. Mm-hmm. Like, I used to cook for myself all the time. And then when I started dating Becky, she was just like, no, I don't want you in the kitchen. This is my stuff, my space. Get out. Mm-hmm. And so eventually I was like, okay, great. I'll, you know, like, take out the garbage and get the groceries and do whatever else. Like, let's distribute labor differently. But baking is so, like at least three times a week, I just fantasize about making bread, which is bizarre.
You and Paul Hollywood. Bizarre.
I very rarely do it, but I'm like, you know what would be a really good use of my time right now is just making a loaf.
I'm imagining Joey bolt upright, like in a cold sweat, just screaming, yeast! Like, it's a really concerning passion you have there, but I like it.
We've gone with yeast and pinching a loaf. So yeah.
It's uphill from here.
Yeah.
That's
Why do you love it?
Oh man, I think the main reason I love it is because of the process. I'm very into whether I'm cooking or baking, setting up my mise en place. And it changed my life. About
I don't
both.
Even know what that means.
Oh, so that was a happy ugh, because it changed the way that I related to, like, all sorts of making food. But it's basically pre-measuring all your ingredients, like pre-chopping all your vegetables, laying everything out so that when you have all of your ingredients ready to go, the exercise of cooking is all about, you know, adjusting your heat and keeping an eye on your skillet and keeping an eye on temperatures and thinking about when to add ingredients in and in what order, rather than that frantic feeling of, oh shit, I forgot to dice the carrots. I gotta dice the carrots. Oh God, I gotta peel the carrots first. Oh God, I don't know how to peel carrots. I don't have a carrot peeler. Like, that stuff doesn't need to happen. And so that process of pre-chopping all the things that are part of the recipe, setting them all out, leveling a tablespoon of baking soda, like, It's my intellectual ASMR. I love it. And then I just love the order of all the little things on the table. And it looks like a perfect Instagram photo that I'll take a picture of and never upload. And it just I don't even need to bake after that. I'm like, I've got a cup of honey that is sitting there and it looks great.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is like you talked about it a little bit before as sort of like a therapeutic exercise, right? Of this sort of exercise that sort of makes you feel calm and sort of levels things out. And I've never thought of it that way, but it like the more I think about it, or like even watching Great British Baking Show and things like that, it's like some of the people who are on there clearly are also using it for that. And so I'm kind of, is there something unique about baking in particular that has like some specific therapeutic effect that maybe like cooking doesn't? Or
well, I actually pivot this over to Jess, because we cannot have a conversation about baking without definitely the best baker I've ever met, who is Jess Vander. It's true, man. It's true. And so I want to like kind
can
of turn
you
that over
the blushing
to you. It's okay, quite it's loud.
I was wondering, as soon as Joey said it, I was wondering if there's something about rule following or not, right?
Order.
Right? Like, here are the rules. Mm-hmm. Follow them or break them as you will. Do it smartly if you're going to do that. But in theory, right, the theory is you do what it says and out comes a magical thing.
Right.
Straight up magic.
Yeah.
Right.
Same ingredients, different ways. You've got a meringue or a flan. Actually, I'm not going to do that because I'm going to get lost. But floating islands, meringue, flan, like it's all eggs and sugar and shit. Yeah. And you just end up with something totally different.
But that's also the process part. And I know this is something I want to talk about with you, Aaron, because I know people bake for different reasons. And I don't know if the uptick in baking is more along the lines of your camp or my camp. But my camp is very much I like baking because more I like people eating the things that I've baked. The process, yeah, that's fine, but it is less valuable to me to bake something if I am the only one to consume it. It's not really, there's no point to that.
It's
you,
a great
you lose
question.
Like the satisfaction at the end
or
of
there's
the rainbow.
Significantly less.
Yeah.
And right, that's not how you feel.
It's true. I definitely am in that sort of, I'm definitely more of an anxiety baker where I think that it's for me much more about my individual experience. It's totally selfish. I wanted to go through the process of all the order of the recipe. I want to learn and then apply knowledge from previous recipes that I've tried and failed or tried and succeeded with. And then I love the fact that I've got all these appliances that I finally get to use. Like those were all investments that were made over many years. So it's like, yes, 10 cents worth of worth of lifetime value. And then there's the first bite. And I love sweets. I am a fan of, and specifically of baked goods. I don't like candy at all. I want a cookie. I want a pastry. I want a slice of cake. And so making something that is right up my alley, and then I have that first bite, I'm good. And it's just like, okay, cool. Like I've got a whole rest of a cake here, but I don't want any more. And so, yeah, of course I'll bring it to other people, but it's all about me. It's totally, it's a very, very selfish exercise.
There's two things that you said that I want to talk about. One, that you're an anxiety baker, which makes me like imagine you like yelling at an imaginary sous chef. What? Turn up the heat.
He's not imaginary. His name is Branch. Yeah.
You call that sifting of the flour?
You should have seen it with the powdered sugar. It was a big deal.
Yeah. But the second part is the sort of learning component that you talked about, which I think is really interesting. Like, and you sort of alluded to something about this, Jess, where it's about following the rules. I mean, the interesting part about baking is that it's much more chemistry and it's much more measured, and it has to be like the ratios have to be perfect. Like if you're making a sauce and you get like the ratios a little bit off, in most instances it's okay, and you're not going to have like a disaster where like your cake collapses in the way that you would with a sauce or like a stir fry or cooking or something like that. But with baking, it is like very particular. And you hear people talk about like their grandmother's recipes, right? When they're talking about cooking. And it's like, my grandmother never measured anything. And I asked my grandmother for like her jerk chicken recipe or something like that. And she's like, well, you just grab some of this, right, and you just throw it together. God, yes. And then you do, and like they're giving these sort of like very vague directions of how to make things. Baking doesn't work that way. You don't have like, my grandmother made an amazing cake that she just pinched different things, yes, until like an amazing cake came out. Like that shit had to be written down. It used to be in like sort of like Rolodex cards or like weird notes.
Oh, yeah.
Like if you're you're getting baking recipes, it's like scrawled on like weird old parchment from your grandmother, right? And because it's like super particular. But people are getting smarter about food in general. At some point, someone was talking about like getting like salt, fat, acid, heat,
yep,
or, you know, Michael Pollan type books or those types of, like people are understanding conceptually more about food, which is allowing them to do more, right? Like you, mm-hmm, were talking about the difference of making the same or a very similar cake between 1 week and the next and how much better you had improved in that time because you were starting to like conceptually understand the distinctions that you needed to make, which I think is really interesting.
It's so gratifying. And that's like, that's probably one of the central reasons that I love it, is that when you learn something in baking and you apply it, your taste buds win.
Yeah.
Like that's a very physiological dopamine reactive feeling. And so when I went from making a carrot cake last week with a dairy-free cream cheese frosting, and it came out really runny and it was tasty, but it was like not what I had in mind.
It was a glaze, not a frosting.
It was much more a glaze. And I would have made a mirror glaze if I wanted to, but I didn't have gelatin. It was a whole thing. And then the next week I did adjust for it, and I learned like, oh, I need to sift, like I need to use much more powdered sugar with these less shelf stable ingredients because they're not traditional butter. And I need to make sure that the powdered sugar is fully sifted because any clumps do not dissolve. As much as you want them to, you will have weird little speckles in your frosting.
And then those clumps mess up the ratio for the rest of the mix and, mm-hmm, all of that.
Yeah, but I think this is where it makes sense that Aaron, you and I have a history with chemistry, each of us. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that is where, yes, this is an exacting quote unquote science, right? But at the same time, part of what makes it interesting being a good baker is knowing when and how you can substitute things, when you can be a little bit, you know, yes, like, oh, this, give or take a little bit of this.
Yeah.
Because some things you can't be like that, and some, mm-hmm, things you can. And having a full grasp of what you're doing, mm-hmm, means you know exactly when you have room and when you don't, when you can substitute X for Y, you know, yeah, especially on the subject of, you know, making dairy-free, lactose-free baked goods. I work under zero constraint, because it's like, add all the butter, mm-hmm, more butter, more eggs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That sounds impossible to me.
I'm never going to forget, in second grade science, they gave us an exercise, which was basically like, you know, tell us how to paint a watercolor picture. And your homework was to write out the steps. And I remember getting the homework back in second grade, and I got like a really low score, and they were making a point. Everybody got a low score. And it was to show you the precision that's necessary for each different step. It's not just open a tube of paint, split, like put it in with water and paint. You had to go through every step, and you had to provide details about what type of paint and, mm-hmm, what type of paper. And it was all to show you that when it comes to science, when it comes to the precision of knowing which elements of what are really important, mm-hmm, you can then have a lot of fun with the things that are just outside of the gray area. But you have to know the repeatability, the specific components that made that exercise repeatable, and, mm-hmm, that can make it repeatable for other people.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's a quick Science Olympiad thing. If you don't know, Science Olympiad is a competitive science tournament for middle schoolers and high schoolers. I used to be a participant, yada, yada, yada.
And
okay, there's an event in Science Olympiad called Write It, Do It. Mm-hmm. And it's an hour or so that's split into two parts, and there are two participants. The first part of the hour, the first participant walks in and is presented with, like, a bunch of Legos or something and has to, like, write down basically a procedure, right? Mm-hmm. Or like, mm-hmm, the steps of how one would build the Lego structure that's there. And you have to be extremely exacting and careful because in the second part of the hour, the first person walks out, the Lego thing is taken apart and it's just the pieces. And the second person has to come in and using only your instructions, exactly recreate the thing that the first person just in theory wrote instructions on how to build. And it's exactly the same sort of concept that you're describing. And I imagine like, you know, when grandma writes down that scrawl on a little sheet, a little index card, and it's just like, bake until it's ready. And you're like, no, grandma, you would have failed this Lego exercise.
How many times have you run into that? Because I have a lot of my grandmother and great grandmother's recipes and little things that I've learned. Like, for this type of cake, I should get my eggs room temperature. But it's literally just like, crack some eggs in some flour and then add some other stuff. And I'm like, no, wet and dry ingredients, separate, sift, mix. Like
mix until it feels right.
Yeah. Like it's frustrating, but it's also realizing a lot of these homemade recipes, and it's definitely worse online now, leave out a lot of these process oriented things that can make a really big difference in the outcome of what your, not just your baked good, but also what your cooked good might be.
The first thing that I'm stuck on still is that, Jess, you'd said that you and Aaron both had a relationship with chemistry at some point. Mm. And it just made me think that you dated chemistry and it didn't work out. But, you know, it's always in your heart. The other part that you're talking about that's sort of interesting with this uptick in baking is sort of this order and satisfaction and thing that you're talking about in a time that feels more intense and complicated.
Unhinged, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, even if we're not making sort of value judgments about the particular events that are happening in the world is happening faster and more connected and we have more shit going on. And so that idea that chemistry or the idea that baking is sort of like a singular event that you have to follow order and it takes a set amount of time and you can't rush it and you can kind of separate. And if you want to do it well, you kind of have to remove yourself from other things. It makes sense that it is sort of like a satisfying and that you can get, you know, you can get satisfaction from it or sort of therapeutic effects for many different reasons, whether it's disconnecting or order or, you know, nurturing or relationships and connection like you were talking about, Jess. But the other part of it that is sort of interesting about people coming back to making their food is some of that Michael Pollan stuff where he was talking about, like, you know, people eat a lot of junk food and whatever. And in one of his books and or the documentaries that they made around his books, he talked about, like, you can eat anything you want if you make it yourself. Mm-hmm. And so when you're like, I really want a piece of chocolate, it's like, okay, make yourself some chocolate. Like you can, like when you go through those exercises of understanding everything that's going into it and like how much sugar you're pouring in and how much fat or eggs or butter or whatever, you both have a better understanding of what the ingredients in the food that you're making are and have a closer concept of like how good or bad that thing is for you. And you're making the own decisions, right? Like even you're talking about alternative baking for health reasons or whatever, you're making decisions now of saying like, I could go with like a full fat coconut milk, or I could go with a light coconut milk, or I could go with some other fat alternative, to make those decisions.
Don't use light coconut milk, by the way.
Yeah. It's everyone terrible. Wants the full fat.
You need it for whisking.
But that idea of like you making your own food as sort of a disconnect, like, you know, if you want a candy bar, like you can make your own candy bars at home. It's a lot of work and it's complicated, but if that's what you want, like if you make it yourself, there's a closer connection to the food and it starts to change the way that people perceive food. And because we've, you know, in like mass manufacturing of food and like Food Inc., sort of as an industry, big food, whatever, we've gotten really separated from the creation of everything we eat.
Okay, but what about when sometimes like someone brings in something and they're like, oh, I made this from scratch at home and it's bad. Right? Like, yeah, you can put in all the time and the effort and have a closer connection with it. And what if it's just gross?
Yeah, you don't have to like everything.
Yeah.
Home baked doesn't mean good.
That's
I think
rare.
It has that connotation.
It does.
And in fact, I was at multiple restaurants recently and was commenting to the person I was with that I was frustrated that on the wall it was like homemade banana bread or something like that. And it's like, it was not made at home. Yeah. This is a cafe, you know, like that's impossible.
Yeah.
Premise made doesn't have the same ring to it, I suppose.
On premise banana bread.
Yeah.
The best kind.
Yeah.
It does. I mean, it does start to get at like this bigger question of like what makes baking itself special. And it feels like what we're kind of swirling around is like, there are many, many things that make it special. However, different periods in time highlight certain things that people need from either the process of baking or what is produced by baking, like baked goods itself. Because I think the two things that feel really strong right now are, yes, I'll hero myself, but this like escape from the chaos of the day. And then also this retreat to a retreat out of manufacture, out of mass production to home. Mm-hmm. I think that those, like, that's two dynamics that are at play that are reasons why Great Britain, British Baking Show, for example, has been able to cross the pond. Even though, again, we need Mel and Sue back. I'm just going to say it again.
Yeah, Mel and Sue.
Mel and Sue.
The last thing I would say that you brought up just before this conversation as we were coming in here is, I think, like, the tight window on the gratification loop. Mm. Like, you put in work, and at the end of that work, there's a cake.
Yes.
Like there's literally like a cookie at the end of this process, right? Like, so the tie between your energy input and something satisfying coming at the end is like a very tight window, and it's very directly connected. Like, if I put in the right amount of energy and I follow the steps and I put care into this, I can get something better at the end. And so there's like a very direct feedback loop that's also part of this in terms of like creation. Like, our job is very intellectual, abstract. On a day-to-day basis, you may not have created something that you can feel like I had something come out of my work today. But when you go home, you can say, like, if I put 2 hours, I'm going to have a cake at the end of that, and it'll look beautiful and it'll taste good. Whereas if we put in 2 hours here, you may have made progress, but it's really kind of nebulous what you've created at the end of that process. And so that feedback loop is, like, I think, really satisfying as well.
Yeah, the reward is a literal cookie.
Yeah.
You're so right. Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah, there's not a carrot at the end of the stick. There's a cookie at the end of the stick.
Unless it's a carrot cake.
Oh, you brought it back.
Genius.
Did it. Thank you.
We're back.
Woo-doo-doo-doo.
From a 3-second ukulele break.
We really need to address that.
Yeah, we do.
There's something I wanted to talk about, and I wanted you guys to help me work through it. And I sort of have the opening premise, but it is a little bit of a Pandora's box, and that's kind of why I wanted to talk about
it. What's a Pandora? Sorry, I wanted a charm bracelet.
Yeah, a Pandora bracelet. That's really actually all I want. I wanted to talk about Pandora bracelets.
Jared, Pandora's on this. Yeah.
What would your three charms be? I wanted to talk about the legalization of sports betting. Because there's been a big movement in the past year, and I follow sports a lot. Like, I listen to a lot of sports podcasts and play fantasy sports and things like that. So I'm always in that realm. But the legalization of sports betting has been kind of a big deal. There's now a show on FS or Fox Sports One that is like an hour every day, a show around sports betting.
What? Right?
It's Jimmy Kimmel's cousin Sal, who is the head writer for his show, has
double what?
Yeah, double what? But this is the reason I want to talk about it is because sports betting, I think, is about to open up a larger set of questions. I think there's sort of trickle down effects when you kind of create this opportunity with an introduction of something that is effectively a drug. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't talk about it because that, but the reward systems in your brain are very attuned to gambling.
Yeah, it's not a fake thing. Like, gambling addiction is not a fake thing. That's an actual.
So what are we getting into by legalizing sports betting?
Quick second.
Yes.
You know how we have a segment on the show called This Is Sports Team?
Absolutely. We've been on it many times.
This is sports team, ball team. Subsegment. This is sports betting. Continue.
It's skee ball.
Hello, Texas skee ball. Chip and Joanna. So I'm afraid about gambling in particular. Like personally, I don't understand. Not that I don't understand it. It does not. It is not a rewarding exercise for me to take the money that I've, you know, put my blood, sweat, and tears into earning and then say, maybe I'll just throw it away and maybe I'll make some more. I hate that shit. I can't do it.
Yeah, so, my money is mostly tears, so I don't want
It's very salty. And that's why, like, I worry about the proliferation of sports betting. I mean, I'm not like this, like, 1920s, you know, person who's running around saying, like, it's going to lead to the devil. But I do think that it normalizing or making that behavior really, really accessible can bring out some inner demons in people. And we're in scary times where those demons run rampant.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really fascinating thing because of sort of some of those like neurochemical mechanisms that are involved mm-hmm. in gambling. And I think as with all things, right, like any drug, caffeine, nicotine, mm-hmm. alcohol, any of those things, like for most people, it's not a problem. But for some subset of people, it is a problem. And you know, the question becomes like, do you not allow it for because it's dangerous for that subset of people? Clearly, gambling is already a legal thing. Like if you go mm-hmm. to a bodega, mm-hmm. it's not uncommon to see someone like running scratchers or things like that, mm-hmm. you know? But the sort of interesting idea here is like sports betting has always been around. Like you could go, you know, find an illegal bookie, or there were sites that existed outside of the US, like some site in the Caribbean or in Germany or wherever, where sports betting was legal and you could still do it. The difference is now that it's legal in the US, and because people care so much about sports and everyone thinks that they know exactly what's going to happen in the next game because they're experts, you know, like armchair quarterbacks and things like that, there is going to be, I think, an increased knowledge in what sports betting is going to be like, right? Like the lexicon of betting I'm expecting is going to start coming in more to everyday conversation of like, what's the spread? What are my odds? Like, you know, what's the over under, things like that, I think is going to start having a larger impact. But there's also potential for some positives, right? Like,
I don't know. The chaotician in me is saying, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, don't do it. Yeah. Don't do it. The thing that I'm thinking about is like predictive markets, right? Which mm-hmm. already exist, but are also, you know, they're used for the most part by like extremely nerdy people, probably not unlike ourselves, who think that they know something and are going to go. There's a website called predictit.com. I don't know if it's predictit.com or org or whatever, but if you search predictit, you'll be able to find it. But people wager on, you know, natural disasters, on like predicting whether when the next earthquake is going to be, or how many hurricanes there are going to be this year, or presidential elections, or the likelihood of a war breaking out in some region of the world. What's interesting about that is that those predictive markets are highly effective at actually predicting when those things are going to happen, which is wild. And so the question becomes, for me, if you have a lot more people engaging in this sort of predictive market, which effectively sports betting is, like, are we going to start having like a better grasp on the future based on sort of just like number theory of having so many people wagering on when something's going to happen?
So, I mean, I take it two places, and I need to go to the first, which is why, and this is an honest question from someone who does not gamble and does not, is not into sports. I'll put it that way. What is the benefit to everyday people of using that superpowered predictive ability to figure out if the Eagles are going to win the next game? Like, why does that matter?
Yeah. I mean, so we were talking about this right before we came in, just kind of like in our scrum ahead of the podcast, and Jess was talking, we were discussing like the Oscars are now part of that. Like the way that sports was defined in this legalization is really thin, right? Like what is and isn't a sport, right? Like you know, is horseshoes a sport? Is darts a sport? Is e-gaming a sport? Like
RuPaul's Drag Race,
is that a sport? Like you can potentially make an argument for a lot of things. And this year is the first year that you can legally bet on the Oscars now, right? And that clearly doesn't feel like a sport, but these sports books are starting to take predictions on that, or right, like things that, you know, maybe that you care about. Like you might be able to bet on the winner of RuPaul's Drag Race in the next season now.
But this is, it still gets to like the inanity or the like complete non-interest that it, like non-impact that any of these sort of things have. So like, I get that there's a lot of money in sports. And I think that that is always an answer to questions about why would people care or try to figure out what's going to happen next. The reality is that you can never know. Like there's a futility in prediction that as someone who spends their every waking day trying to figure out the future and to project the future is a little bit of a conflict.
Then, so I bake.
Exactly. So instead, cake.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, so a friend of mine recently explained poker staking to me, which if you don't know, it's similar. It's like betting on the betting, right? You put in some money to support a poker player before they go and play in a tournament, and whatever then percentage that you supported them in, you get a certain corresponding percentage back if they do take home the pot. So in that space though, it isn't, you know, it isn't about the end game being, oh, I predicted some outcome and that's cool. It's like it's expanding the game. And there was recently some other podcast episode, which I will have to link in here too, about this, which just it shows how the world of that is so expansive, and particularly in the world of poker, it actually diversifies the gambling and the amount of risk that you're taking on each individual bet, because it's 5% here and 5% there, and you're not putting all of your marbles and dollars literally on yourself or on one player. It's on a bunch of players. Is there a world where in this, you know, diversified sports betting space where, you know, you aren't risking everything and you're just playing more?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's that component, which makes me think about the idea that you're fundamentally like educating people on probabilities, like coming back to the idea of like baking, educating people on chemistry. Like betting is an education on probabilities and like risk management and game theory and all of those things. The other part of this sort of the question to like, is this all just inane? Is I think when you start going into more real world events, which it seems like these sports books are going to be able to do, and predict it is already doing. So if people start getting into this gambling through sports books, even if it's not through them, Predicted is a legal place where you can put real money down on wagering on real world events. The idea is that, like, so Sir Francis Galton, who was brilliant and a total shitbag, he like made incredible contributions to humanity, was also an aggressive racist,
unsurprisingly.
But he basically came up with, you know, the wisdom of crowds, the concept of like vox populi. He basically founded meteorology through data surveys, polling, questionnaire. I mean, the guy made incredible contributions to the world. If we can look past that, he was a black soul, like dirty person in his heart, basically the Grinch. But he came up with that idea of the wisdom of the crowds, and basically the idea that he found it at like a local fair where people were trying to guess the weight of a cow, I believe. And 800 people wagered on this or put in a vote on the weight of the cow, and you won something at the end. And he got to see the ballots and was able to say like the middle line, like the either the average or the median of these guesses was actually the weight of the cow. And you can see this in a lot of places. And so if we're people start like actually trying to predict world events, or if you and I are running a political campaign or some initiative to make an impact around climate change, if we can see the predictive markets, how they're performing, we could then potentially act on that of adjusting a policy proposal, or like there are some sort of democratic implications to this. I know like who wins the Eagles game is inane to your point, but who wins a presidential election or will this ballot measure pass is less inane, and people are already in these predictive markets wagering on that. And so is the process of these like sports betting becoming popularized going to improve predictive markets?
But let's like push it then one step out.
Yeah.
My name is Tom Cruise. I'm in a new concept car from Audi, and I'm worried about a murder that's happening and a murderer that is afoot. Oh no, in a world of perfect knowledge, the police department has told me that I will commit the murder. This is the plot of Minority Report, right? Like, and I think that there is a bit, the issue that they explored in that movie is like what happens when seemingly infallible systems of knowledge can be flawed. Mm-hmm. And granted, it's not the same thing that like this sort of like this distributed knowledge of the crowds is going to completely move us that quickly that far. But making decisions based on things that haven't happened yet, mm-hmm. and especially given our tenuous relationship with knowledge and truth right now, that evolving scares me. I think that if anything, the past couple of years has taught us that the voice of the people or the voice of the masses and the opinions of the masses do not equally impact everyone in a positive way.
Right.
And that's putting it extremely lightly. So in that sort of like assessing ballot measures and figuring out bigger policy decisions based on things that haven't happened yet and based on the will of a broader set of people, that scares me. That doesn't fill me with confidence that it's actually going to move in a that policy will still move in an intelligible or smart or safe direction.
Yeah, I mean, it what's interesting is like these markets move like a stock exchange, right? Like if on a predictive market, if you're wagering on one presidential candidate today, you're still sort of potentially trying to like short or gamble on those markets. So you could say, mm-hmm. like to Jess's idea of like expanded game theory within wagering, you could say today Kamala Harris for the Democratic nominee is
Kamala
is the top or is in the middle, but you believe that person's going to go up. You can start to hedge your bet over time or see how the market's moving and do different things. But these markets are going up and down on a day-to-day basis based on public sentiment or public events or things like that. So it becomes another input, I think, versus, you know, in the sort of Minority Report example. And I suppose maybe there is some sort of dystopian future in how these markets could get used, but it becomes interesting to me. Like there's other examples, like predictive markets were better at predicting the future price changes in like microchip costs versus like major tech companies, right? Mm-hmm. Who have like supercomputers and all of the data and all of the information and the relationships. Predictive markets were still somehow better at predicting future costs of things. And so there's almost like there's this ability to get knowledge that you can't otherwise get just based purely on like the distributed knowledge of people. So there are like clearly good and bad things coming out of this.
I don't know why I'm the dismal naysayer of it all.
We need it.
Yeah. We need a dark cloud descending like Batman.
But the idea of like, I mean, the other dark side of this is like we're probably gonna get to a point where you're going to the bodega instead of someone running scratchers. They're like, I'm gonna take the over under on the Eagles versus the Patriots. or you know, like here's $20 on the money line for the Giants game or something like that.
My sports smile is gonna get so good. It's you know, when people start talking about smorts when people start talking about sports and I just sort of smile and then I name one person who plays that sport and then hopefully walk away very slowly. I'm going to do that in every 7-Eleven around New York City.
Yeah, you're going to be like plus 700 on the Giants. That's like, what if you become like super expert on?
Oh, all I know is like Roethlisberger. Like it's going to be names of people. Although I think he's a terrible person,
yep, terrible person.
Awful human. But yeah, weird names, sports ball, predictive markets.
It's ski ball.
All about sports.
Thanks, guys. This was Sports Betting. Brought to you by Sports Team.
Critical Nonsense is a Sylvain Labs production.
Recorded in MacGyver Studios in beautiful New York, New York.
We'd like to thank Aaron for coming back to us.
Hi.
As well as our now bookie. She learned through this episode to become a bookie, executive producer, Jess Vander.
We'd also like to thank sound engineer and pistachio sheller, Alex Contell.
We'd like to thank designer Nora Mestrich for just high-fiving.
And that production team, you know, the inimitable Les Jacobs, the fantastic Sari Gilbert, and the un-somethingable Tony Vong. The unimpeachable Tony Vong. Like that.
And as always, thanks, Alain.
Appreciate it.
We'd like to give a special thanks this week to Tom Cruise.
Yeah, you know, I would also like to thank Ina Garten. Yeah.
Ina Garten.
Mm-hmm. Yup.
We'd like to give a special thanks to sports ball enthusiasts everywhere.
Such good enthusiasts. And actually, one of our biggest fans, special thanks to Ken Griffey Jr., just a sports ball person.
Another
I can think
name
of.
That Aaron knows. Mm-hmm. We'd like to give a special thanks to Paul Hollywood, as well as a serious reprimand.
Oh, yes.
For getting rid of Mel and Sue.
Absolutely. And you know what? Special thanks still to Mary Berry. Love you, girl.
Mary Berry's hands make me uncomfortable.
But I love her, so that's important. I also want to thank Kite Hill for making amazing dairy-free products, including cream cheese.
I'd like to thank my body for giving up on dairy.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to thank it. I'm mad at it.
Really?
What?
You're now lactose too?
No. No.
What? Joey.
Nuts, lactose.
Luckily, this is the best time in all of history.
Yes.
Because every other milk exists.
And you're in the best city for it, legitimately.
Thanks, oat milk.
Yeah.
Thanks, Oatly, for producing high quality oat water milk.
Yes, barista style.